Chapter 35. And freedom of the odious imputation which Petal endeavors to cast upon his memory. But justice has removed the veil with which an impious hand endeavored to cover itself. Already, on the night of the 1st of November, suspicion was awakened by the extraordinary agitation of Petal, by those excessive attentions towards his wife, which came so late, by that excessive and noisy grief, and by those calculated bursts of sorrow, which are such as nature does not exhibit. The criminal, whom the public conscience had fixed upon, the man whose frightful combinations have been laid bare, and whose falsehoods, step by step, have been exposed, during the proceedings previous to the trial, the murderer, at whose hands a heart-stricken family, and society at large, demands an account of the blood of a wife, that murderer is Petal. When, my dear Briefless, you are a judge, as I make no doubt you will be, when you have left off the club all night, cigar-smoking of mornings, and reading novels in bed, will you ever find it in your heart to order a fellow sinner's head off upon such evidence as this? Because a romantic substitute du procureur de Roi chooses to compose and recite a little drama and draw tears from juries, let us hope that severe adamantine judges are not to be melted by such trumpery. One wants but the description of the characters to render the piece complete, as thus. Personages' costumes. Sebastian Petal Murtrier habiliment complete de notre perfide. Figure pale, barbe noire, cheveux noirs. Louis Ray sold at retire, bon, costume ordinaire, il port sur brave, frank, jovial ses épaules une couverture de aimant levin, lescheval. Femmes, la gaite, ses maîtres sur doubt, vrai francais, enfin, wolf lieutenant de gendarmerie. Felicite del Kaiser femme victime de Petal. Medicines, villagiois, fils d'auberge, garkins d'écurie, and c, la scene c passe sur le pont d'andert, enter macon a belly. Il est minuit. La pluie tombe. Les tonnerres grondent. Le ciel est convert de nuages, a cylind declares. All these personages are brought into play in the procureur's drama. The villagers come in with their chorus. The old lieutenant of gendarmes with his suspicions, Ray's frankness and gaiety, the romantic circumstances of his birth, his gallantry and fidelity, are all introduced, in order to form a contrast with Petal, and to call down the jury's indignation against the latter. But are these proofs, or anything like proofs? And the suspicions, that are to serve instead of proofs, what are they? My servant, Louis Ray, was very somber and reserved, says Petal. He refused to call me in the morning, to carry my money chest to my room, to cover the open car when it rained. The prosecutor disproves this by stating that Ray talked with the inmates and servants, asked if his master was up, and stood in the inn yard, grooming the horses, with his master by his side, neither speaking to the other. Might he not have talked to the maids, and yet been somber, when speaking to his master? Might he not have neglected to call his master, and yet have asked whether he was awake? Might he not have said that the inn gates were safe, out of hearing of the hustler witness? Mr. Substitute's answers to Petal's statements are no answer at all. Every word Petal said might be true, and yet Louis Ray might not have committed the murder. Or every word might have been false, and yet Louis Ray might have committed the murder. Then, says Mr. Substitute, how many obstacles are there to the commission of the crime? And these are, 1. Ray provided himself with one holster pistol, to kill two people, knowing well that one of them had always a brace of pistols about him. 2. He does not think of firing until his master's eyes are open. Fires at 6 paces, not caring at whom he fires, and then runs away. 3. He could not have intended to kill his master, because he had no passport in his pocket, and no clothes, and because he must have been detained at the frontier until morning, and because he would have had to drive 2 carriages, in order to avoid suspicion. 4. And, A most singular circumstance. The very pistol which was found by his side had been bought at the shop of a man at Lyons, who perfectly recognized Petal as one of his customers, though he could not say he had sold that particular weapon to Petal. Does it follow, from this, that Louis Ray is not the murderer, much more, that Petal is? Look at argument number 1. Ray had no need to kill two people. He wanted the money, and not the blood. Suppose he had killed Petal, would he not have mastered Madame Petal easily? A weak woman, in an excessively delicate situation, incapable of much energy, at the best of times. 2. He does not fire till he knows his master's eyes are open. Why, on a stormy night, does a man driving a carriage go to sleep? Was Ray to wait until his master snored? He fires at 6 paces, not caring whom he hits, and might not this happen too? The night is not so dark, but that he can see his master, in his usual place, driving. He fires and hits whom? Madame Petal, who had left her place, and was wrapped up with Petal in his cloak. She screams out, "Husband, take your pistols." Ray knows that his master has a brace, thinks that he has hit the wrong person, and, as Petal fires on him, runs away. Petal follows, hammer in hand. As he comes up with the fugitive, he deals him a blow on the back of the head, and Ray falls his face to the ground. Is there anything unnatural in this story? Anything so monstrously unnatural, that is, that it might not be true? 3. These objections are absurd. Why need a man have change of linen? If he had taken none for the journey, why should he want any for the escape? Why need he drive 2 carriages? He might have driven both into the river, and Mrs. Petal in one. Why is he to go to the Downs, and thrust himself into the very jaws of danger? Are there not a 1,000 ways for a man to pass a frontier? Do smugglers, when they have to pass from one country to another, choose exactly those spots where a police is placed? And, finally, the gunsmith of Lyons, who knows Petal quite well, cannot say that he sold the pistol to him. That is, he did not sell the pistol to him. For you have only one man's word, in this case, Petal's, to the contrary, and the testimony, as far as it goes, is in his favor. I say, my lud, and gentlemen of the jury, that these objections of my learned friend, who is engaged for the crown, are absurd, frivolous, monstrous, that to suspect away the life of a man upon such suppositions as these, is wicked, illegal, and inhuman. And, what is more, that Louis Ray, if he wanted to commit the crime, if he wanted to possess himself of a large sum of money, chose the best time and spot for so doing, and, no doubt, would have succeeded, if fate had not, in a wonderful manner, caused Madame Petal to take her husband's place, and receive the ball intended for him in her own head. But whether these suspicions are absurd or not, hit or miss, it is the advocate's duty, as it appears, to urge them. He wants to make as unfavorable an impression as possible with regard to Petal's character. He, therefore, must, for contrast's sake, give all sorts of praise to his victim, and awaken every sympathy in the poor fellow's favor. Having done this, as far as lies in his power, having exaggerated every circumstance that can be unfavorable to Petal, and given his own tale in the baldest manner possible, having declared that Petal is the murderer of his wife and servant, the Crown now proceeds to back this assertion, by showing what interested motives he had, and by relating, after its own fashion, the circumstances of his marriage. They may be told briefly here. Petal was of a good family, of Macon, and entitled, at his mother's death, to a considerable property. He had been educated as a notary, and had lately purchased a business, in that line, in Belly, for which he had paid a large sum of money, part of the sum, 15,000 francs, for which he had given bills, was still due. Near Belly, Petal first met Felicite Alcazar, who was residing with her brother-in-law, Monsieur de Montrichard. And, knowing that the young lady's fortune was considerable, he made an offer of marriage to the brother-in-law, who thought the match advantageous, and communicated on the subject with Félicité's mother, Madame Alcazar, at Paris. After a time, Pétel went to Paris to press his suit, and was accepted. There seems to have been no affectation of love on his side, and some little repugnance on the part of the lady, who yielded, however, to the wishes of her parents, and was married. The parties began to quarrel on the very day of the marriage, and continued their disputes almost to the close of the unhappy connection. Félicité was half-blind, passionate, sarcastic, clumsy in her person and manners, and ill-educated. Pétel, a man of considerable intellect and pretensions, who had lived for some time at Paris, where he had mingled with good literary society. The lady was, in fact, as disagreeable a person as could well be, and the evidence described some scenes which took place between her and her husband, showing how deeply she must have mortified and enraged him. A charge very clearly made out against Pétel is that of dishonesty. He procured from the notary of whom he bought his place an acquittance in full, whereas there were 15,000 francs owing, as we have seen. He also, in the contract of marriage, which was to have resembled, in all respects, that between Monsieur Brousset and another demoiselle Alcazar, caused an alteration to be made in his favor, which gave him command over his wife's funded property, without furnishing the guarantees by which the other son-in-law was bound. And, almost immediately after his marriage, Pétel sold out of the funds a sum of 50,000 francs that belonged to his wife, and used it for his own purposes. About 2 months after his marriage, Pétel pressed his wife to make her will. He had made his, he said, leaving everything to her, in case of his death. After some parley, the poor thing consented. Asterisk, asterisk, this is a cruel suspicion against him, and Mr. Substitute has no need to enlarge upon it. As for the previous fact, the dishonest statement about the 15,000 francs, there is nothing murderous in, that nothing which a man very eager to make a good marriage might not do. The same may be said of the suppression, in Pétel's marriage contract, of the clause to be found in Brousset's, placing restrictions upon the use of the wife's money. Mademoiselle d'Alcazar's friends read the contract before they signed it, and might have refused it, had they so pleased. Asterisk Pétel, says the act of accusation, did not fail to see the danger which would menace him, if this will which had escaped the magistrates in their search of Pétel's papers, was discovered. He, therefore, instructed his agent to take possession of it, which he did, and the fact was not mentioned for several months afterwards. Pétel and his agent were called upon to explain the circumstance, but refused, and their silence for a long time interrupted the instruction getting up of the evidence. LL that could be obtained from them was an avowal that such a will existed, constituting Pétel his wife's sole legatee, and a promise, on their parts, to produce it before the court gave its sentence. But why keep the will secret? The anxiety about it was surely absurd and unnecessary. The whole of Madame Pétel's family knew that such a will was made. As he had consulted her sister concerning it, who said, if there is no other way of satisfying him, make the will, and the mother, when she heard of it, cried out, does he intend to poison her? After some disputes, which took place between Pétel and his wife, there were continual quarrels, and continual letters passing between them from room to room. The latter was induced to write him a couple of exaggerated letters, swearing, by the ashes of her father, that she would be an obedient wife to him, and entreating him to counsel and direct her. These letters were seen by members of the lady's family, who, in the quarrels between the couple, always took the husband's part. They were found in Pétel's cabinet, after he had been arrested for the murder, and after he had had full access to all his papers, of which he destroyed or left as many as he pleased. The accusation makes it a matter of suspicion against Peitel that he should have left these letters of his wife's in a conspicuous situation. All these circumstances, says the accusation, throw a frightful light upon Peitel's plans. The letters and will of Madame Peitel are in the hands of her husband. 3 months pass away, and this poor woman is brought to her home, in the middle of the night, with two balls in her head, stretched at the bottom of her carriage, by the side of a peasant. What other than Sebastian Peitel could have committed this murder? Whom could it profit? Who but himself had an odious chain to break, and an inheritance to receive? Why speak of the servant's projected robbery? The pistols found by the side of Louis's body, the balls bought by him at Macon, and those discovered at Belly among his effects, were only the result of a perfidious combination. The pistol, indeed, which was found on the Hill of Dard, on the night of the 1st of November, could only have belonged to Peitel, and must have been thrown by him, near the body of his domestic, with the paper which had before enveloped it. Who had seen this pistol in the hands of Louis? Among all the gendarmes, workwomen, domestics, employed by Peitel and his brother-in-law, is there one single witness who had seen this weapon in Louis's possession? It is true that Madame Peitel did, on one occasion, speak to M. de Montrichard of a pistol, which had nothing to do, however, with that found near Louis Ray. Is this justice, or good reason? Just reverse the argument, and apply it to Ray. Oh, but Ray could have committed this murder? Who but Ray had a large sum of money to seize upon? A pistol is found by his side, balls and powder in his pocket, other balls in his trunks at home. The pistol found near his body could not, indeed, have belonged to Peitel. Did any man ever see it in his possession? The very gunsmith who sold it, and who knew Peitel, would he not have known that he had sold him this pistol? At his own house, Peitel has a collection of weapons of all kinds. Everybody has seen them. A man who makes such collections is anxious to display them. Did anyone ever see this weapon? Not one. And Madame Peitel did, in her lifetime, remark a pistol in the valet's possession. She was short-sighted, and could not particularize what kind of pistol it was, but she spoke of it to her husband and her brother-in-law. This is not satisfactory, if you please, but, at least, it is as satisfactory as the other set of suppositions. It is the very chain of argument which would have been brought against Louis Ray by this very same compiler of the act of accusation, had Ray survived, instead of Peitel, and had he, as most undoubtedly would have been the case, been tried for the murder. This argument was shortly put by Peitel's counsel. If Peitel had been killed by Ray in the struggle, would you not have found Ray guilty of the murder of his master and mistress? It is such a dreadful dilemma that I wonder how judges and lawyers could have dared to persecute Peitel in the manner which they did. After the act of accusation, which lays down all the suppositions against Peitel as facts, which will not admit the truth of one of the prisoner's allegations in his own defense, comes the trial. The judge is quite as impartial as the preparer of the indictment, as will be seen by the following specimens of his interrogatories. Judge. The act of accusation finds in your statement. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.